Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating showdown between the House and the White House over Trump's defiance of subpoenas and apparent contempt for the legislative branch's constitutional role of oversight, and speak with Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, whose latest book just out is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era. He joins us to discuss the latest roadblock thrown up by the executive branch, with Attorney General Barr now threatening to not show up at Thursday's hearing before the House Judiciary Committee because he objects to the format of questioning by Democrats. We will assess what options House Democrats have since Trump has now found his Roy Cohn, William Barr, and whether it is possible to dispatch the House Sergeant of Arms to arrest Treasury Secretary Mnuchin for breaking the law in not turning over Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee. Then we'll speak with an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism, David Nywert, whose latest book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. He joins us to discuss the latest attack on a house of worship by a white nationalist who shot up a synagogue near San Diego, California, killing one and wounding three after posting a manifesto online referencing the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and the mosques in New Zealand, while taking credit for the recent burning of a mosque in nearby Escondido. We'll look into how Trump is trying to have it both ways in condemning the latest display of neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism, just days after he tried to whitewash his comments about fine people in Charlottesville, again refusing to say that Nazis are bad people. Then finally, we'll examine the growing delusion among white supremacists that a global white genocide is underway and analyze the broader picture of the rise of right-wing nationalism in Europe and the United States with Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University, whose latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. He joins us to discuss the demagoguery of a third world tin pot dictator who happens to be America's commander in chief, ranting about imaginary coups and whether Trump has gone full on fascist, as he did before the NRA issuing the not so veiled threat that if the deep state tries to impeach him, the good guys with the guns will take to the streets. And joining us now are Darrell West, the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, and his latest book, Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era, a book that's just out. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Thank you, Ian. It's nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Darrell. And what do you make of this escalating battle now between the executive branch and the House Democrats? I think in the historical context, I'm not sure there's ever been anything quite like it. I believe in 1927, somebody involved in the teapot scandal or a relative of somebody involved was jailed. I think I believe there is a jail cell in the basement of the Capitol. And I think in 1934, somebody else in the executive branch was also, I don't know, whether they were arrested. So do you have those historical references?
I mean, there have been some historical cases where that has happened, but it's been very rare, and it shows how truly unusual the current confrontation is. The fact that Attorney General Barr is threatening not to show up before the House Judiciary Committee for a scheduled hearing, that's pretty unprecedented. There are individuals who are denying documents that have been either requested or subpoenaed by House committees. You mentioned the issue of Trump's tax returns. That certainly is headed for litigation. So it's a very unusual time and a very dangerous time in American politics.
And what's happening with the person that the Democrats have subpoenaed or are trying to subpoena, who apparently overturned the intelligence community's recommendations not to give intelligence clearances to Jared Kushner?
They have worked out an agreement there where the person has agreed to be has agreed to a private testimony in the presence of a White House lawyer. So with a White House lawyer present, that individual has agreed to testify, but again, you know, individuals like that, we need to have public hearings. He needs to be testifying before a public setting because everybody wants answers to the question about how Jared Kushner's security clearance was handled and how, you know, given the fact that there were so many red flags that normally would prohibit the issuing of a security clearance, somehow the White House overruled them. So we need to find out exactly what happened there.
But don't you think, Dara West, what's really going on here is that this is a president who thinks he's dodged a bullet or thought he dodged a bullet with the way that Barr handled and spun the Mueller report and is now realizing that it's not satisfactory, that the House, there's so many, if anybody actually reads the report, it's pretty damning, and they are following up on it. And essentially what's going on, and it seems, at least it seems to me, is that the one piece of testimony that took place that was damaging to Trump was Michael Cohen's. And Trump simply does not want any more testimony like that. And he's just doing anything he can because he can't. He just doesn't want this information getting out to the American people.
Absolutely. And there's this old line, you should never spike the football until you're actually in the end zone. And Trump has violated that because when the Mueller report first came out, or when the Attorney General Barr put out his four-page letter on that, basically Trump concluded he was completely exonerated on all fronts. And, of course, now that the actual redacted report has come out, that is not the case. There is a lot of damaging evidence in there, and there are lots of questions where we need additional information so we can actually answer them. And so Trump is now basically moving into full-time obstruction and basically refusing to let people testify. They seem to now be invoking executive privilege, even though the very officials have previously been given testimony to Mueller's investigation. You know, you can't really retroactively invoke executive privilege when the person already has talked about the issue at hand. But, you know, it's just all of these tactics are designed to keep the American public in the dark and not put out information that probably is going to be damaging to the president.
And again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. And his latest book just out is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era. So how much do you think the hyper-conflict that we have is clearly being generated by Donald Trump? And my sense is that this is somebody that didn't expect to be a president, and indeed the testimony I mentioned that Michael Cohen gave to the House, he said a couple of times that Trump would say throughout the campaign that this campaign is the greatest infomercial for the Trump Organization. So that seems to have been his motive to burnish his brand and essentially use the electoral process and all of the $5 billion worth of free advertising that the mainstream media gave Trump to basically make money. And then, and so now he's stuck with a job he doesn't know how to do. He's, the only job that he really knows how to do is to con people and to be a reality TV star. And then that is how he governs. It's like government by stunt. Every day he has to distract us all. And, you know, here I am as a member of the media feeling like every day I'm being manipulated. Is that ultimately what this is all about? So that we don't we have to put this latest round into that context, albeit that maybe he's upping the ante?
He certainly has upped the ante, and Trump has clearly escalated the hyper-conflict that I describe in my Divided Politics book. It's not that he started it. The conflict has been growing over a number of decades, but he certainly has pushed them to new heights, probably for some of the reasons that you just discussed. You know, he's somebody who always has mixed politics and business. Now that he's a president, he can do that on an even grander scale, and it raises all sorts of conflict of interest questions. And that's the reason why these current investigations are so important, just to get at what has happened. What happened in the case of Russian meddling, which the Mueller report documented as a systematic effort on the part of the Russians, questions about obstruction, the fact that Trump wanted to get Mueller fired, which would have, would have been a clear-cut legal violation had that been followed through on. So there's just so many issues where we need more information, and Trump is basically standing up to Congress and saying, I'm not going to provide that kind of information.
So to the question, though, going back to the historical record, apparently there is a jail cell in the basement of the Capitol. And what would happen if Darrell West, if the House Sergeant of Arms was dispatched to arrest Steve Mnuchin, who is violating the law in not turning over Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee? The law is really clear on that. So is that feasible? Could they do that, drag him out of the Treasury building in handcuffs?
I don't think that is likely to happen, but there are things that Congress can do. So, for example, when a committee issues a subpoena either for documents or for the testimony of an executive branch official, if that person just refuses to show up or doesn't provide the documents that are requested, that individual can be found in contempt of Congress. That person can be subject to fines. There are some members of House Judiciary who already have stated publicly they think that if that executive branch individual continues to stonewall and not provide information that Congress has requested, that there could be that person could be sent to prison. I don't think it'll be a sergeant of arms going out and personally arresting someone, but they would go through the normal legal process of somebody who's found in contempt. So that could be an option as well. But I think there's clearly going to be litigation over these issues. And I'm sure what Trump is counting on is that the current Supreme Court will back him up, because he has five people on that court now who have a very broad view of executive power. And that's going to be the issue that ultimately is going to come to the fore in these cases. Like, is Congress exceeding its authority, or is the president allowed to withhold information even though Congress has requested it? I expect that issue ultimately to come before the Supreme Court.
So an old friend of mine is Alexander Butterfield, the person who provided the evidence of the White House taping system that really brought down Richard Nixon and President Nixon. It was prior to the revelation of the taping system. It was all the president's men against the president, but then suddenly there was evidence. And Alex told me that he was getting a haircut on his way, because at that point he was the head of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, getting a haircut. He was on his way to Russia. He got a phone call from Sam Ervin, the chairman of the Watergate Committee, the Senate Watergate Committee, saying, you've got to come and testify right now. And he said, I can't. He told the lawyer, I can't. I'm on my way to do government business in Russia. And the phone rang shortly thereafter, because he's watching live on television. He's looking at the hearings, and he sees Ervin talk to the lawyer. The lawyer goes through the back door, and the next thing, the phone rings in the barbershop, and it's the lawyer saying, the chairman just said, if you don't come over right now, he's going to dispatch the Capitol Police to arrest you. So that would indicate to me that there is some course of action or some law enforcement assets that the House has.
Yep. No, I think that is the case. It's going to be a question of what is the sequence by which they pursue these types of things. So I think the first thing will be holding somebody in contempt and threatening fines and seeing if that will produce the needed action. And if that doesn't work, members of Congress certainly will file suit, and it'll go through the legal process. I think those will probably be the next steps, and hopefully that will resolve at least some of these issues.
But since Donald Trump has found his Roy Cohn in William Barr, surely Barr is not going to cooperate, for example, with the Steve Mnuchin case. I don't see Barr agreeing to arrest Mnuchin.
I certainly agree that members of Congress are going to face a daunting task here, because the Attorney General is acting as Trump's personal lawyer and kind of undertaking steps to protect him. I think what Barr has to be careful about, that he does not end up engaging in obstruction of justice in his own right. Because remember, in the Nixon case, which you just cited, it wasn't so much the original actions, but the cover-up that ultimately did in Nixon. And so both Trump and Barr have to be careful that they don't continue the obstruction in ways that get themselves in even greater legal jeopardy.
So how do you personally, since you're a student of the government and government structures and institutions, Darrell West, is there anything that we're missing in this? This does appear to be, I mean, obviously the founding fathers set up a system of checks and balances so that there's sort of inbuilt tensions there that are by and large positive. But when one branch, in this case, the executive branch, decides that, or at least the president decides he's above the law and he's just playing hardball, and he literally is, in fact, following Roy Cohn's playbook. He's not just playing hardball, he's countersuing. He's countersuing Chairman Elijah Cummings. So is there anything that we're missing here? My sense is that the founding fathers didn't necessarily predict a Donald Trump.
They did not predict a Trump. And you're right that the executive branch is playing hardball. But we should also keep in mind Congress can also play hardball. And there is a wide range of things they can do, even beyond what we've been talking about. Like, you know, if Trump is basically going to obstruct and just deny any information to Congress, people in the House can basically quit approving things that Trump wants. It could stop legislation. It could stop the appropriations process. I mean, there are lots of ways, lots of things they can do to put pressure on Trump. So what I would anticipate is this battle is really going to escalate. It's a very risky time in American politics because our whole system is based on checks and balances. That clearly is very much under a threat right now.
Well, just in closing, recently Trump refused an airplane for Nancy Pelosi, who was supposed to make a trip to Afghanistan. And that was an example of Trump sort of pettiness and playing hardball. Could Pelosi refuse to put gas in Trump's Air Force One so that he couldn't go visit the Queen?
She could certainly do things like that. You remember she played hardball as well, in the sense that he wanted to give the State of the Union address at the end of January. And she basically said, by the way, we have to invite you. You can't just show up and give a speech. And she basically said, we're not inviting you at the time that you wanted, and essentially forced him to delay the speech. So, you know, if he plays hardball, she is certainly going to respond in kind. And, you know, this crisis will escalate and hopefully not reach a breaking point, but, you know, it clearly seems to be headed in that direction.
Well, Darrell West, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who's Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. And his latest book just out is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the latest attack on a house of worship by a white nationalist.
Police are thieves in the street. Fight of the nation with their guns and ammunitions. Police are thieves in the street.
Wild, 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 wild
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Nywert, who's an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism, whose books include The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, and his latest book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Nywert.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, thank you, David. And this shooter that shot up the synagogue in Poway, just outside of San Diego, it looks as though, mercifully, his assault rifle jammed, and he was only able to kill one person and wound three. And apparently the rabbi had literally tried to confront him, and I guess he tried to use his hand to push the gun away and had his fingers shot off. So we don't know the full details of the horror that took place there, but it does seem to have not – obviously, it has not been as terrible as what happened in Pittsburgh. And, of course, it happened on exactly 6 months to the day after the Pittsburgh attack. And in the manifesto that was posted online, apparently, by this shooter, a 19-year-old who has an otherwise fairly – ordinary American background. His father was a school teacher. He went to a Presbyterian church in the neighborhood, etc. He did post a manifesto that referenced the Pittsburgh shooting and also the mosques in New Zealand. And also he took credit for trying to burn a mosque in nearby Escondido. But the thing that stands out is that he's blaming the Jews for emigration, which is exactly what the shooter in Pittsburgh did. So where's that coming from?
Donald Trump. I mean, seriously, Donald Trump tweeted no less than, a year ago that George Soros was responsible for the caravan coming to the border, that this is being financed by Soros. So, yeah, no, it's coming right from the very top. It's coming from Donald Trump. It's coming from Fox News. It's obviously coming from, all the conspiracy theorists out there that are nativists pushing, nativist nonsense. It's really a troubling phenomenon.
Well, but in the manifesto, the writer identifies himself as a Christian of European descent, and he says he doesn't have any political labels, but it's full of these far right accusations that the Jews are trying to destroy the white race through immigration of non whites. I know that Trump is stirring the pot, but there's this sort of delusion out there that, amongst the white nationalists, both in the United States and in Europe, that there's a white genocide underway. Explain that, if you will, because it's obviously a delusion, but it's serious enough to have people killed. That's what bothers the hell out of me.
Well, sure. No, we're awash in really a flood tide of conspiracy theories right now. And without question, the ones that are really causing most of the, flooding the zone of violence are white nationalist ones. And the most popular one is the one that in fact, the Poway shooter cited, the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory, also cited by the Christchurch shooter, also cited by Anders Breivik, also, all of these other violent mass shooters, all believe this conspiracy theory that was concocted by white nationalists in the 1990s called cultural Marxism. And it's basically Protocols of the Seven Elders of Zion rewired for the 20th century. It's telling people that a cabal, secret cabal of Jews, has been conspiring to enslave and destroy Western civilization, and that they are succeeding in doing it by promoting all of these, the postmodernism and what they call the degradation of standards. And it's really, that's what they've been telling people. And these young white men in particular are attracted to it because they go out and recruit young white men to believe it.
Well, but in the current context where the Republican Party is using the specter of Marxism and basically trying to paint Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the sort of the red menace that's about to destroy American capitalism, she's not Jewish. I mean, how does that fit in? Because there's no question. I mean, I'm not blaming the Republican Party for what happened at the synagogue in Poway, but I have a feeling that if cultural Marxism is the trope, then they've got their fingerprints on that one too.
Well, sure, because cultural Marxism, you know, that particular trope shows up on Fox News. I've got a clip of a former talk show host, Chuck, what's his name, sorry, repeating it. And it's also... I mean, it shows up not just on Fox News. Obviously, it's a major trope that shows up on Breitbart News. It shows up in all these various right-wing sites. It shows up, you hear Rush Limbaugh reference it now. You hear all of these right-wing talkers reference it. And it's just spread right into the mainstream. And this is part of the problem. I mean, this is really the root of the problem, is that the Republican Party has allowed this extremism to seep into it, and not just seep in, but is actually taking it over. And so, yeah, I don't know that we can blame the Republican Party for this, but the Republican Party has its fingers in the pie. They share certainly culpability for the spread of this anti-Semitism, spread of the alt-right, because they have not only do they sit by and repeat their stuff in a sort of soft-pedaled fashion, but then they vociferously deny and attack anyone who calls this stuff out. They, you know, if you attack the fact that, you know, call out the fact that we're being deluged with various forms of domestic terrorism and hate crimes right now that are all really because people feel they've been permission to give that, to act this way by Donald Trump. If you know, when you call that out, you're attacked nastily, but the reality is that's what's actually happening.
And again, I'm speaking with David Nywerth, who's an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism, whose books include The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, and his latest book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. Well, of course, one of the more respectable people who has been writing in the New York Times is Barry Weiss, and she's done these glowing profiles of alt-right intellectuals, if that's not too generous a term for the Stephen Bannons of the world. So she's also been calling out critics of Israel as anti-Semites. You know, this is another part of it that I find hard to understand, why these young white people take up assault rifles. They obviously have easy access to them and start killing people in mosques and in synagogues. You'd have to be really, Rip Van Winkle not to notice that Donald Trump and Netanyahu are best buddies. I mean, Netanyahu is going to name a town on the Golan Heights or a settlement after Donald Trump. So where's this idea? They love Trump. But they're anti-Semites, and don't they notice that Trump loves the Prime Minister of Israel, and isn't that the home of the Jews? I mean,
yeah. Well, they overlook that. It's like that they make exceptions for Trump for various things because it's just like when he comes out and mumbles a few words where he says, "Well, I denounce white supremacists." They actually laugh at that stuff because they see it as they don't take it seriously. They think he's just saying what he has to say to maintain his political legitimacy. Secondarily, they actually don't object strenuously to Netanyahu, in part because Netanyahu is very clearly part of this larger flood of right-wing authoritarianism. He's very clearly a right-wing authoritarian himself. And this is what we're talking about here. All these Trump followers, Trump himself, when we talk about Putin and what he is doing, promoting in Europe with these far-right parties, it's all about right-wing authoritarianism in various shapes and forms. And that is really the larger phenomenon that we're having to deal with now. And people who believe in liberal democracy, you know, need to wake up and understand that democracy doesn't just naturally reproduce itself. It can come under attack from authoritarian regimes and authoritarian belief systems. And we are very much under attack right now.
Well, Obama made the remark a while back about Trump and Charlottesville. You know, what's so difficult about saying that Nazis are bad people? But Trump clearly can't do that. And recently, Joe Biden, in announcing his presidential run, brought up Charlottesville, and that sort of baited Trump into, you know, picking the scab on that wound. And he talked about Charlottesville. Uh-huh. Of course, he lied, as he does 9,000-plus times. He lied, saying that it was really the comment about good people or fine people on both sides was to do with the statue of Robert E. Lee, which, of course, it wasn't.
Right.
When you
right.
get back.
That's right. The Friday night rally was not anywhere near the Lee statue. It was around the statue of Thomas Jefferson on the University of Virginia campus. And the guy who organized it, Richard Spencer, announced that this march tonight, the Tiki Torch March, was about taking it beyond the monument. So, yeah, that's a flat-out lie. Flat-out lie. And every one of those 1,000 guys or so with tiki torches, every single one of them was a white nationalist. Every single one. They all came with torches because Richard Spencer told them to.
Well, I wonder, though. I mean, I know that Trump, he's not doing anything about the Russians interfering in our elections, and that's one of the reasons why he fired the Homeland Security woman, because she wanted to do something, and he doesn't want to do anything about it. And he also doesn't want to even say anything about the Nazis and the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists. He jumps through hoops to avoid criticizing them. And we know that because of he's intimidated the law enforcement people. And by the way, in the rally he had on Saturday in Green Bay, Wisconsin, up against the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which the White House and the White House staff are boycotting, he talked about the FBI and the Department of Justice people he doesn't like as scum. So he's attacking our law enforcement. And my understanding is that the FBI is just not looking at these white nationalists who go and shoot up synagogues and will probably do more. Is that your understanding since you study the alt-right?
Well, actually, I do study this quite a bit. The FBI honestly does a fairly good job of staying on top of this element. They've been responsible for most of the preemptive arrests, in fact, all of them, of some of these characters, including, you know, this guy, Christopher Hassan in Baltimore, as well as the three men in Kansas who were plotting to truck bomb a refugee settlement. But and the problem really is more that the DHS is not doing this work adequately anymore, and also the fact that we've really limited it to to just the FBI handling it. And yeah, I actually do have real concerns about the extent to which this is prioritized within law enforcement. It's very obvious that right-wing extremism is a much lower priority for law enforcement at all levels, not just the federal, but also the state and the local levels. It's within the culture of law enforcement officers in America right now that they're very right-wing and they do not take the threat of right-wing extremism seriously. And this is something I've encountered everywhere from Portland to Seattle, or, you know, Portland and Seattle to Washington, D.C. And it's a real problem, and I don't know. You know, it's obviously something we have to take a really hard look at, especially if we can ever win some elections again.
Well, David Nywood, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with David Nywood, an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism, whose books include The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. And his latest book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the broader landscape of the rise of right-wing nationalism in Europe and the United States.
And some might say that it's a waste of time, cause ain't no amount of dancing finna break the bondage. We go to war and transcend space and time, when every record ain't a record just to shake behind. You know the stakes is high, we in the face of drama. That's why we can't shake it or escape the problem. It's like a game of roulette, the barrel revolving. They only wanna see us occupying a coffin. Mothers crying too often from they lost child leaving. We trying to get over, get under, get even. Get inside, getting it, getting dumb, getting greedy. We got to get it right, it's not about to be easy. Come on.
Tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, which was the winner of the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy. And his latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much, Ian. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Jason. And the president, of course, just a few days ago, after Joe Biden, in announcing his presidential run, had talked about Charlottesville, Trump took the bait and opened up that wound. But this time around, he lied. He said that the fine people on both sides was reference to the statue of Robert E. Lee, which it clearly wasn't. But then of course, in response to the latest massacre, or at least it wasn't a massacre, but only because the shooter's gun jammed at the synagogue just outside of San Diego, Trump said all of the right things. But I still recall what President Obama said about Trump, where Obama sort of said, you know, what's so hard about calling Nazis bad people? And what is so hard about calling Nazis bad people?
Because a number of them are his supporters, so, and he's loyal to his base. Now, the president is not personally an anti-Semite. I don't think there's a question. He's not personally an anti-Semite. However, when you talk about a globalist conspiracy, when you talk about nationalism, when you talk about, you know, criminal aliens and lax immigration laws created and promoted by globalists, and when you raise panic about socialism, then those are anti-Semitic dog whistles. So you might not yourself be an anti-Semite, but anti-Semites are going to hear those dog whistles because, of course, the core of Ku Klux Klan ideology, the core of Nazi ideology, is that Jews are behind lax immigration laws, and they're seeking to bring in non-whites to destroy the white race by intermarriage. So the president is not personally an anti-Semite. However, when you talk about the country's lax immigration laws that are the mockery of the world, essentially citing National Socialists, you are cueing in people like the Pittsburgh shooter, Tree of Life shooter, whose ideology, remember, the ideology there was the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society was helping immigrants. So this anti-Semitism is, Western anti-Semitism, Nazi anti-Semitism, is the idea that Jews are leftist socialists who are bringing in immigrants to destroy the white race. And the president is saying everything except the Jews part. So that sends a clear signal.
So if to the in mind of these white nationalists and neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, the Jews are race traitors, how does that – is it a combination of Jews and leftists?
So this is what people don't understand about Nazi anti-Semitism, and you also find this in the Ku Klux Klan. The idea is the ultimate goal of Jews, according to this hideous Nazi ideology, is that Jews seek a socialist, Bolshevik, communist takeover of all the institutions, the universities, the newspapers, and ultimately the world. They ultimately seek a world communist domination, and they're using the financial industry to do that. So that strand of anti-Semitism, there are different strands of anti-Semitism. One kind of anti-Semitism does target Jews for their religion, but Hitler's strand of anti-Semitism, Nazi anti-Semitism, says that Jews seek to overthrow white Christians by destroying nations, making borders open, and creating world socialism. And we're hearing everything except the Jews part.
Right, but what keeps this alive? It's obviously alive. It's on the internet, and that it informed this shooter in San Diego, and it has informed others as well, including the horrible Australian fellow that massacred the Muslims in New Zealand.
You found the straight down the middle ideology. The Australian killer, Brendan Tarrant, he says, you know, Jews are fine as long as they're in Israel. it's ethno-nationalism. What you find rising around the world today is ethno-nationalism. And it sounds great. Everybody just stay in their own place. But the fact is there's a lot of different people already in places. And so if you want everyone to have their own place, that's going to involve killing or moving a lot of people away.
Well, that's pure Steve Bannon. That's his appeal in Europe, isn't he? I mean, he's running around Europe now, and I don't know who's backing him, but he's got considerable backing, and I know that Putin is certainly an ally, if not a backer. The idea is to get the right-wing nationalist parties in Europe, like Le Pen in France and the AfD in Germany, to get enough votes in the European Parliament to get to a third, one-third level, so they can have veto power and paralyze the European Union, which of course serves Putin's interests, but. Why is Bannon doing this?
I don't think we actually need to focus on Bannon, and Bannon might be a sideshow. Today is the day of the Spanish national elections. Vox, the far right party, which mirrors these ethno nationalist parties, it mirrors Trump, it mirrors Bolsonaro. They're talking about gender ideology and universities controlled by leftists and the immigrants coming in through open borders, all the things we hear, and preserving, being proud of Spain's history, you know, even the fascist part, all that part. Well, their intellectual leader, not Abascal, but the real leader of Vox, came to Washington, and the Trump administration arranged meetings between him and Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos and Elaine Chao, Secretary of Transportation. So it wasn't Bannon who arranged those meetings.
So Jason, your close friend and colleague at Yale, the historian Timothy Snyder, I believe you and Timothy Snyder are testifying before the Canadian Parliament in a few days. What is that about?
So we're speaking in front of the Committee of Foreign Affairs and speaking to them about challenges to liberal democracy in Europe. So precisely this issue. We're speaking about the perils posed by ethno-nationalism to European liberal democracy, which is the situation we face here, too. I haven't talked to Professor Snyder in the last couple of days about what his testimony is going to be, but I think both of us are going to talk about the need to talk about religious toleration for minorities. We're seeing horrific killings of Christians where Christians are minorities in the terrible massacre of Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, we're seeing killings of Muslims. We're seeing killings of Jews. We're seeing these targeting of ethnic minorities because ethno-nationalism is the view that the dominant group should, you know, get everything, should dominate the culture. And when you spread that, well, yeah, you're going to see violence against Christians in countries where Christians are not the majority. And that's the ideology that we're going to face. So I think both of us are going to be talking about the peril of these far-right ethno-nationalist parties. But I think European liberal democracy might be stronger than the U.S. variety. I don't think those parties are going to win much more than 10%.
But you get the feeling, though, that the connective tissue on the right here is this idea of walls. Trump's his whole thing is about building a wall on the southern border, not on the northern border with Canada, where you're testifying, but on the southern border because the people to the south are brown and not white. And you got the same thing in Europe where the Italians now try, obviously the right ran on the immigration issue of people coming across the Mediterranean, many of whom drown on the way. In Spain, I suppose it's also there. Is it? Tell me more about the Vox leader. I'm absolutely shocked to learn that the Trump administration set up meetings with the resurgent fascist in Spain with Betsy DeVos and Elaine Chao, the wife of the head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell.
So this was reported in the Spanish news. I don't know how much it's been reported here because people don't really know Vox. But I don't know the content of those meetings. I mean, clearly the Trump administration is linking up with Netanyahu, Bolsonaro, all these far-right leaders, and you find a very similar in Trump's speech to the NRA. He talked about his targeting of universities, which is the supposed free speech bill, that executive order that he signed, which threatens universities with defunding if they don't protect the free speech, if they police the speech of their students. Now, I am all for free speech. You will find no greater champion of free speech than me. But campuses are the places where you can most freely speak right now. And it's somewhat paradoxical to police campus speech to make sure it isn't policed. I mean, there are free speech issues on campus. I mean, BDS speakers, I'm not a supporter of BDS, but I believe that BDS speakers have every right to speak about BDS and give arguments for it, just as I have rights to give arguments saying it isn't an effective strategy. So there are free speech issues on campus, but that's not what's going to be targeted by this executive order. So we have these attacks on universities. Bolsonaro recently declared, said he was going to defund philosophy and sociology departments in public universities and focus on job training. You have the privatization of everything. And this is a global campaign backed, I'm afraid, by energy companies and people with financial interests in getting working class people to be enraged by the wrong things.
Well, what they should be enraged about is global warming, because if you don't want people emigrating from Africa. And after all, the civil war in Syria was in many ways generated by global warming. We know that what's happening in Central America is that global warming is affecting agriculture to the point where the poor Hondurans and Salvadorans and Guatemalans simply are starving. So and there's also lawlessness because we support these right-wing narco dictators in these countries, they're all coming up here. So if you had any intellectual consistency on the right, you would be all in favor of doing everything you could to stop global warming as quickly as possible. Because if you think there's too much emigration from brown and black people polluting the white purity of Europe and the United States, you haven't seen anything yet.
I'm afraid that's not how fascism works, Ian. I believe it's a very clever strategy. It's one that you find and discussed in Arendt. I discuss it in How Fascism Works. You make the problem worse. The goal of what you do in fascist politics is you make the problem worse so you can continue running against it. If there's no less global warming and if there's less strife in poorer countries, then you can't demagogue about black and brown immigrants anymore. So you make the problem worse. It's like Richard Nixon, who made crime worse so he could run in 1972 again on a law and order platform.
Well, Trump's making everything worse, so...
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made this point. She said, why is it that the politicians, she tweeted this, why is it that the politicians most outraged about immigration are the ones who don't believe in global warming? Now, of course, the answer is because they want to make the problem worse. That's why they want to make more desperate immigrants flow over borders so they can run again saying, look at all the desperate immigrants.
Well, let's just, in the last few minutes, though, I really wanted to, you brought it up, Jason Stanley, and that is Trump's speech before the NRA a couple of days ago. And I found it really frightening. It was the demagoguery of a third world tin pot dictator who happens to be America's commander in chief. And he was ranting about these imaginary coups. And I wonder whether or not Trump has gone full on fascist.
So Trump's rhetoric, he was also inventing things. I mean, he's not really inventing. I mean, he did this stuff with crime. I mean, crime, violent crime is at among the lowest it has been. You know, he said it's the greatest increase in violent crime in 25 years. Well, you know, in 2007, there were 1,423,000 violent crimes. In 2015, there were 1,199,000. So that looks like a lot less violent crimes, you know. So, you know, crime has slowly risen a little, but because it's at such historic lows in the final Obama years, it was in such historic lows that a slight rise is going to be a larger percentage rise. So he was fear-mongering demagoguery about non-existent crime waves. That's what he ran on 2016. And then he was talking about coups and all the paranoid things. And we're in this sort of unique moment where we have a leader who is engaging in this clearly anti-democratic rhetoric, riling people up for civil war, basically, to get... And, you know, you read about this in the history books in the 1930s. People, Victor Klemperer is talking to people like, Hitler's just using rhetoric. It's just rhetoric. Don't take him seriously. Now, I will say that the Trump administration is not doing what anti-democratic regimes of the past have been doing. Their actions have not been been nowhere near as extreme as the rhetoric in certain cases. So, for example, they have been prosecuting the armed militias on the southern border. Their rhetoric encourages those militias. Those militias are emboldened because of the rhetoric. But hopefully we will not be in a situation where they let the militias and the different extra-legal groups emboldened by their fascist rhetoric have free rein. They are holding to the rule of law, and so it is a strange moment. It's unprecedented. We've never had a president speak like this. And as somebody who studies rhetoric, we know that rhetoric has effects, but the Trump law enforcement administration is not letting vigilantes loose. They do seem to be reining them in, but it's frightening. It's a frightening moment.
Well, but when Trump went on about how the Democrats are trying – it was a coup. The Democrats are trying a coup, and he referred to their continuing efforts to impeach him. And he mentioned that, you know, we exposed the coup. We didn't even have to use guns. He's talking to a bunch of people who have described themselves as the good guys with the guns, the NRA. Don't you think that there's a clear, not-so-veiled threat there, that Trump is basically saying that if the deep state tries to impeach me, the good guys with the guns will take to the streets?
Look, he's been saying that now repeatedly, and it's getting more intense. He's talking about bikers for Trump. He's talking about our guys have the guns. You know, the rhetoric is terrifying. In the moments in the past when the rhetoric was like this, the reality closely followed, and like the government wouldn't pursue armed vigilantes or armed militias. And that's not the case right now. The Trump administration is not letting armed militias wander around on the streets hunting people down. But on the other hand, Trump is engaging in the rhetoric. So I would say, as a scholar of this matter, it's very concerning. I mean, he is definitely whipping people up into a frenzy. He's engaging in the worst sort of demagogic fascist propaganda, as I lay out in How Fascism Works. If you just look there, you'll see that this is the propaganda. This is very frightening propaganda and rhetoric. And it causes violence. It creates people. He's talking about alien and criminal aliens. Suddenly, all immigrants are criminal aliens. That was a quick slip.
Right. Well, my understanding is that in the month between the time that the Mueller report was handed in and the time that Barr was able to basically talk Mueller out of indicting the president, which I understand is what really happened behind the scenes, a part of Barr's argument to Mueller was, you know, we can't have a coup against the president because his supporters will take to the streets with guns. So it's out there.
I've heard that line. I've heard that line at from security. Yes, I've heard that line. And it's a legitimate,
right.
You know, that's what the rhetoric does.
Right. So it's already being used as a veiled threat, or not so veiled threat, isn't it? The idea is you've got to keep me in power, otherwise the crazies, I'll unleash the crazies. So that's one.
Absolutely. It's being used as a threat, but as it were, the people, when these armed militias, recently we've learned about the armed militias in the southern border, and the Trump administration has been reining them in, but you're absolutely right. I mean, that's why I call the situation unprecedented. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are we supposed to do with this rhetoric that is clearly very dangerous?
Well, Jason, I'm afraid we've run out of time. Yeah. I very much appreciate you joining us, and I'd like to do a follow-up with you and Professor Snyder about what happened in Canada. So let's stay in touch.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, which was the winner of the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy. And his latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.